Good morning, everybody. 5:02:41, and it is April 29th. Today's the 29th. Sunday was the 27th. All right, so your grades are in Blackboard. Got one more test left in the class. A couple people have come to take a look at their exams, but not everybody. And I recommend that everybody do come take a look at your exams. A lot of times I hear from students, actually quite frequently, oh, I didn't think I selected that answer. I knew that answer. Okay, so I think it's a really good idea to come by and take a look at your Scantron and just make sure that you're focusing on bubbling in the right answers for all of those questions. Okay, and if there's smudges or something like that, I think everybody has a grade in Blackboard. I think all the tests got put in the right lab sections and everybody had a name on it. But if you don't see your grade in Blackboard, then you got to see me because there's something happened. Maybe you changed your name. I'm not sure. That happens too. All right, so we're going to start Blood, Heart, and Circulation. That's chapter 13 today. And so 13 is going to be on the last test, and so will 14. And that's all I know for sure right now, but probably some things in these other chapters as well. So the final test is still a couple of weeks away, and we'll just figure out what's going to be on that test as we go. Okay, so you just got to keep coming to lecture. Okay, so let's start with chapter 13. Unless somebody has a question. Anybody have a question? Probably not. Okay. So what are the functions of the circulatory system? You know the anatomy of the circulatory system pretty much already. Anatomy is with the heart, blood vessels, maybe lymphatic system, part of the circulatory system. And so you know that blood is a connective tissue, but it's kind of a strange connective tissue because under normal circumstances it's a liquid, it's a fluid. But it can change state. It can become a solid under certain circumstances, and we'll take a look at why that happens and how it happens. But since it's a fluid, it connects all different parts of your body because it's flowing from one region to another. So it can transport oxygen and nutrients, enzymes from one part of the body to the other, and hormones, important delivery system for hormones. And as a matter of fact, all hormones are delivered to their target tissue by the circulatory system. All right, so, but not only good things that your body needs, but it helps get rid of toxic compounds and waste products. For instance, like carbon dioxide. It takes carbon dioxide away from tissues. We don't want that in our body. We need oxygen in our body, and you're familiar with that because we covered respiration already. Another thing that the circulatory system does is that it can absorb heat in one part of your body and deliver that heat to another part. And so it's important for heat transfer. And if you're using muscles, they certainly will heat up. Blood goes into that muscle and will heat up. And when it gets back to the hypothalamus, there's a temperature receptor there. And then there'll be vasodilation of blood vessels on the skin. You'll start sweating. And then that will get rid of that heat, right, from your skin. But the heat in your skin came from muscles. And the way that it gets there is through the blood. Another important thing, maintain fluid, electrolyte, pH balance in all tissues. So there are buffers, right, and all kinds of electrolytes. We're going to look at another really important electrolyte in this chapter once again. And there are white blood cells and antibodies in blood, so it can protect your body from disease-causing microorganisms and foreign substances. And in a lot of cases, blood can even attack tumors that you have in your body. And as a matter of fact, probably we've all had tumors in our body, but your immune system recognized it early on and got rid of it before you even knew you had it. And it's hard to measure. Maybe it even happens to all of us, maybe 5 or 6 times a year. I don't really know. Okay, that's just conjecture. Or maybe it's happening all the time, and your immune system gets rid of those things that are misbehaving. And since blood is a fluid, when a blood vessel is damaged, then that fluid will just leak right out of that blood vessel. And so you'll lose blood. So there are mechanisms with blood to prevent blood loss. right, to plug up that blood vessel so that blood doesn't run out. That's a pretty important part of this chapter. All right, so we talked about the components a little bit, heart and lymphatic systems and vascular as well. So the heart is a pump. It pressurizes blood. And why does it pressurize blood? Because of this equation right here. We want it to flow. We want blood to flow. Well, how does something flow? We want a nice, pretty simple equation that shows us why something flows. And it could be, and a fluid could be a gas or it could be a liquid. It really doesn't matter. The you know what? I'm going to put down flow right here. All right, so the force that drives these fluids around is pressure. All right, so I'm going to put pressure right here. And as you increase the pressure, what happens to flow from one place to another if there's a difference in pressure? If you increase pressure, what happens to flow? It increases, right, because it's directly related. Well, there might be some resistance to that flow or impedance to that flow, which will slow the flow down. So we also want to take into account resistance. All right, so flow is going to be equal to pressure, right, in the numerator, and resistance in the denominator. So if resistance increases, what happens to flow? It decreases because it's inversely related. So that's a nice basic equation that you should memorize. And we're going to modify it some. I'm sure you've modified it in lab already. Okay, so that's how blood flows in your body. The lymphatic system does a pretty interesting thing because there are capillaries that lose fluid. And you have capillaries all over your body. That fluid would build up in your tissues and you'd swell up a little bit one day and swell up even more the next day and keep swelling. But there is another part of the vascular system that can take that excess tissue fluid and return it back to the circulatory system. And those are the lymphatic vessels, right? So the lymphatic system picks up excess fluid that is filtered out through capillaries and returns it to the vein. And when that happens, lymph is going to flow through something called a lymph node. And a lymph node filters the lymph and looks for microorganisms, and if there's microorganisms, the lymph nodes will design antibodies and contact killers to get rid of that microorganism. So they get busy. So for instance, sometimes you might have an infection, and maybe you even notice some lymph nodes in your neck or some other region of your body start to expand, start to get bigger, and that is because indeed they are growing, they're producing things that will fight that infection. All right, so let's look at specifically at blood for just a little bit, and we'll get to the heart a little bit later. All right, so if we were to take a syringe and take some blood out of a person's body, right, it'd look nice and red. That substance that we take out of a blood vessel is what we call whole blood. All right, so not just blood, but whole blood, which also means then that there are some components. There's some parts that we need to put in blood to make it whole blood. We have about 5 liters in our body, and whole blood is made up of basically these two kinds of things, two compartments, the fluid part and the solid part in blood. Right? The solid part is just basically cells, and the fluid part is what we call plasma. So the two parts are plasma and formed elements. Formed elements are the cells. Let's take a look at plasma first. Mostly it's made out of what? What is plasma mostly made out of? Mostly made out of water, right? And then other things dissolve in that water. So they have to be hydrophilic kinds of compounds. And 8% of plasma is proteins, right? And these can be clotting factors that prevent blood loss. They can be globulins that fight infection or even transport molecules. There was a globulin that we looked at that transported thyroid hormone around in your body because thyroid hormone is hydrophobic. It has to bind to a globulin. And then here is another important one. This is albumin. And it's important for water balance because how will water diffuse? How will water diffuse? You could even think of maybe this pressure equation right here. How does anything diffuse from high concentration to low concentration? Right. So here we have a lot of albumins in the blood, and as we increase these proteins in the blood, what happens to the water concentration in blood if we increase the solute? So this albumin is a solute. Right. So what happens to water concentration if we increase albumin? Water concentration decreases, right? Okay, decreases below the water concentration in tissue spaces. So water concentration in tissue spaces is high. Water concentration in blood vessels is low because of all of this albumin right here. And so now you can figure out what happens to water, which it can move, right? Because there's a concentration gradient. So which way will water move? From tissue spaces back into blood vessels, right? And that also fights swelling, just like the lymphatic system. If something happens to all these albumins, they're not being produced, then guess what would be one of the consequences? If your blood all of a sudden has less solute and more water molecules, what happens? Water, instead of diffusing into a blood vessel, might actually even diffuse out of a blood vessel. And that's what we call edema, or swelling. So without these proteins, you would swell up. And indeed, people that have liver damage, because this is where albumins come from, one of the side effects of that is swelling all over their body, right? So you're familiar with the osmotic pressure. So albumins help regulate osmotic pressure so that fluid does not build up inside your body. Okay, then besides water and proteins, we've got some ions, nutrients, gases. You're familiar with oxygen and CO2. Right, and waste products as well. All right, so that's the fluid part. Sometimes we might want to use a serum or an anti-serum, and it would be really nice to know what the heck is a serum in terms of all of our definitions. So serum is not made out of cells. There's no cells in serum whatsoever. It's from plasma. But if we were to take that plasma, just plasma from a person, it might actually clot as well. And so if we take out all the clotting factors, if we take out all these clotting factors from plasma, then we get something that we call serum. So serum contains albumin, it has the right water concentration, it has things that fight infections, or maybe an antidote to a venom, something like that, but it just doesn't contain clotting factors. All right. So let's move on to formed elements. These are cells. Basically, we got three kinds of cells. And one is a red blood cell. These don't have a nucleus. They don't have organelles, but they do have enzymes in there for glycolysis, so they can produce a little bit of ATP. All right? And there's not even room for a nucleus because they're filled with another compound that is designed to absorb oxygen from the lungs and then deliver it to tissues to absorb and then release oxygen. And that chemical is hemoglobin. So red blood cells filled with hemoglobin for oxygen transport to cells. All right, so because there's no nucleus, if there's any kind of damage to a red blood cell, there's no way for it to repair itself. Or if something happens where it needs a lot of ATP, it can't because it's only making ATP through glycolysis. So a red blood cell, right, can only live for a short period of time, maybe only about 120 days, and then it dies, and it should be recycled after that. All right, so that's most of the formed elements. And then we have white blood cells, and these do have nuclei, and some of these nuclei are pretty spectacular. They have a number of different lobes to them. It's just not a sphere inside the cell. And all of the white blood cells, the five basic kinds, are there to fight infection, part of your immune response, one way or the other. And then the last part, platelets. Right, these are really small. These are just cell fragments. You can see them underneath a microscope, but it's really difficult. As a matter of fact, it's pretty hard to see a red blood cell underneath a microscope unless you really know how to use a scope. And platelets are even more difficult because they're maybe just 10% the size, one-tenth of a red blood cell. But these are important because they become activated when a blood vessel is damaged and you need to prevent blood loss. So they're involved with a certain kind of clotting mechanism, blood clotting mechanism. And these don't have nuclei either, and these don't live for a very long period of time either. Right. So if there's a blood bank, red blood cells don't last very long. Platelets, how long will a blood bank keep platelets around? I should look that up. It might only be a week. right? Because they don't live very long at all. There are some other names for red blood cells, right? The Latin name for red is erythro, right? And Latin name for white is leuco. And a blood clot or clotting is thrombo. And then we just add a site to all of those things. So an erythrocyte is exactly the same thing as a red blood cell. Leukocyte is exactly the same thing as a white blood cell. A thrombocyte, same thing as a platelet. All right, so those are all the components of blood. And here we have a test tube, and we've taken out a whole blood sample. So what are the two parts of a whole blood sample? Yeah, you got plasma and formed elements. Well, sometimes there's a disruption in the production of red blood cells, of formed elements in somebody, and we would just like to understand what is happening there. How, what, is there formed elements changing, right, or is it normal? So we take a whole blood sample, put it in a test tube or some kind of container, and we could put this test tube on a workbench and let it sit there overnight, and then all the heavy stuff will, of course, sink to the bottom, and all the light stuff will be, the lighter stuff will be up on the top. And then we come back in the morning, we could measure the volume of red blood cells because they're heavy down at the very bottom of this test tube. We could also measure the whole volume within this test tube and then calculate what is the percentage of red blood cells that we collected in whole blood. And that has got a very important name that's called the hematocrit. So hematocrit is just the percentage of red blood cells in whole blood, and not white blood cells, right? So here is a buffy coat that's made up of platelets and red blood cells, and it kind of looks white or a cream color. Another thing, what would happen if we took a whole blood sample from somebody that's dehydrated? Maybe they were out in the desert exercising, lost a lot of water. What would happen to hematocrit? What would happen to hematocrit? Okay. Yeah, the hematocrit would go up. As you dehydrate, you get more and more red blood cells compared to the plasma, and that actually can be pretty dangerous, right? Because then the blood gets harder to flow from one part of your body to another, and you need to get some water into the blood just to maintain this hematocrit. Or if you're losing too many red blood cells, right? And I think you know what that condition is. What do we call that condition when somebody is low on red blood cells? That is anemia, right? Anemia. So there are a lot of reasons why we want to look at hematocrit. And we can see that under normal conditions, there's a difference in men and women. 36 to 46% in women, a little bit higher, 41 to 53. Of course, there's some overlap in men. And that increase is driven by testosterone. So I have a question right here that you should work at home just to make sure that you know what hematocrit is. And the question is, if you have an 80 milliliter sample of whole blood, right, you just took this out of somebody's blood vessel, and this is a normal individual, and if that sample contained 30 milliliters of erythrocytes, 0.72 milliliters of leukocytes, 4 mLs of thrombocytes after centrifuging, is the sample from a man or a woman. So you want to be able to calculate hematocrit and compare it with these numbers right here and tell me if it's a man or woman, or maybe you can't tell. Maybe it's in this overlap. All right, centrifuging is a way of separating the formed elements from plasma very rapidly, right? So instead of waiting overnight for these things to settle out, and a centrifuge will spin this tube and it will spin all the heavy stuff down to the bottom of the tube. Right, so you'll be able to measure hematocrit in just a couple minutes rather than hours and hours and hours. All right, so the figure here, we see erythrocytes. They look like a disc, but there's a little dimple on the top and on the bottom, which we can't see. So it has a large surface area, right? And how do you think of surface area? What is surface area? Oh, I'm sure we did this. I got a ruler out. Remember, I was over there, and I measured the, what did I measure? The doorway. Yeah, so when we say surface area, you want to think of doorway. So red blood cell has this particular shape to increase its surface area or its doorway that allows for exchange, for oxygen moving across the cell membrane and CO2 as well. All right, these other things are the leukocytes And of course you can see these funny shaped nuclei in them, and these tiny things over here are the platelets, just like what we described. Okay, plasma proteins, kind of talked about this already, maybe about 9% of, now is this in, is this a formed element or is this plasma? It's a part of plasma, right? It's not any kind of cell, these are just molecules. All right, so albumin we talked about because it helps maintain tissue fluid or reduces tissue fluid because it draws water from tissue spaces back into the blood. Globulins, oh, we said, yeah, carries lipids like thyroid hormone, for instance, and other steroid hormones. And also other kinds of globulins fight infection. One thing that was not on the previous slide is fibrinogen. And fibrinogen is an important component for blood clotting that prevents blood loss. So whenever you see a term with an ogen on the end of it, we call that a suffix, whenever there's an ogen on a word, you know that it is inactive. It's not doing its job, right? But it can be converted very rapidly into an active component, right? So fibrinogen is inactive. When it becomes activated, then, right, this ogen gets chopped off and it just becomes fibrin. So we're going to look at a couple a prefix and a suffix, which means a precursor to the active form. Fibrinogen is a part of plasma. It dissolves in plasma, and guess what about fibrin? When fibrinogen is converted into fibrin, it no longer can dissolve in plasma. And does anybody ever take a chemistry class? What do we call that? When there's something in solution and all of a sudden it jumps out of solution and forms a solid. What do we call that? I think I heard. It's called precipitation, right? When a particle turns into a solid in a fluid and comes out of a solution. So fibrinogen is converted into fibrin. You could think of that as a precipitation process. Fibrin is not soluble in liquid. Becomes a solid. Right, and of course serum, we defined serum already. Here's another way of defining serum. Okay, we talked about these formed elements already. Leukocytes. Some of these leukocytes are pretty important because they're shapeshifters. So they can crawl around inside your body looking for things that don't belong there. We're just going to call those antigens, bacteria, viruses, and they move by what we call diapedesis. So here I see a leukocyte actually crawling out between a little intercellular cleft between cells that make up a capillary. And when they bump into a bacteria, they surround it, they phagocytize it, and then bring that bacteria to another part of the immune system so that that immune system then can recognize that pathogen and build some defenses against it, like can start to build some antibodies or other kinds of cells that can attack it. Okay, so I don't think I have much in the way of having you know the differences, some of the subtle differences between these different kinds of leukocytes, but you should at least be aware that there are 5 of them. Okay. And platelets are very important because they prevent blood loss, and they come from a precursor cell. We call these a megakaryocyte, and they're found in bone marrow. As a matter of fact, most red blood cells are produced in bone marrow. And these things, just know that they're important for clotting blood, but they can also cause vasoconstriction. They can cause a blood vessel to get smaller, the diameter of a blood vessel to get smaller. Okay, survive 5 to 9 days. Oh, that's a really short period of time, much less than 120 days. All right, so if a blood vessel is leaking blood, it's a really good idea to vasoconstrict it, so that increases the resistance. And if the pressure is the same, if we increase resistance by squeezing down on a blood vessel, what happens to flow? It's inversely related, so blood flow is going to be reduced in that damaged blood vessel, and then, of course, you'll have less blood loss when that happens. All right, there are some abnormal circumstances where the blood vessel is diseased, but it's not broken, it's not leaking blood, and serotonin might be released and causes vasoconstriction. Right. And what happens again when a blood vessel vasoconstricts? What happens to flow? Yeah, flow decreases. And for instance, if that's a blood vessel in the heart, like a coronary artery that goes into spasm, vasoconstriction, right? Now, that's not going to prevent blood loss, but it's going to reduce blood flow to the heart, and that might actually cause a heart attack, right? So that's two different effects. One maintains homeostasis, and the other, right, then does not maintain homeostasis, but puts that heart in a diseased state. Hematopoiesis is just a term that we use to talk about making blood cells, any kind of blood cells, whether it's platelets or white blood cells, or red blood cells. And, do I want to mention this right now? Probably don't want to mention this right now, in just a little bit. There are two different kinds of hormones that regulate the production of white blood cells and red blood cells. Production of red blood cells is called erythropoiesis, right? Erythro means red, formation of red blood cells. It's stimulated by a hormone from the kidneys that we call erythropoietin. And we get it from kidneys, and in order to get it years ago, we'd actually have to take a kidney and grind it up and isolate this hormone from a kidney before we could give it to somebody. Right, but now, EPO is a specially genetically produced kind of erythropoietin. Somebody found the gene for erythropoietin, a human gene, took it and put it in a bacterium, and the bacterium then multiplied and multiplied and multiplied with that gene, and now we've got billions and billions of billions of bacteria that produce erythropoietin all day long. And it's easy to then get that erythropoietin, right, and give it to people. We don't have to grind up kidneys anymore. All right, so EPO is just a genetically produced form, it's not really synthetic. It's really the human erythropoietin, but it's being produced by bacteria for us. All right, leukopoiesis, on the other hand, is the formation of white blood cells. It's stimulated by other kinds of hormones that we call cytokines. Some of these are autocrine regulators. Sometimes a cell will secrete something that will change its physiology. And it's also activated by the immune system. Will control the production of white blood cells. All right, so here is erythropoiesis. So what's the end product of erythropoiesis? Is a red blood cell in particular. And what's the hormone that stimulates this process right here? It enhances this process. It is erythropoietin. And here it is, stimulated by erythropoietin, right on this slide. Okay. Well, we said that this cell, these red blood cells, don't have a nucleus, can't repair themselves when they're damaged, can only make ATP via glycolysis, it doesn't have mitochondria, so it doesn't live very long, maybe about 120 days. All right, and then it dies. Well, then bone marrow and spleen and liver will break this red blood cell down and recover the important chemicals that are inside of it and maybe get rid of some other things. The important chemical, anybody remember what the name of that important chemical was for transporting blood? It's called, I don't remember mentioning it. It's called hemoglobin. Okay, so this red blood cell is loaded with hemoglobin. It's a big organic compound. And in order for hemoglobin to do its job, it has to have an iron element in it. So there are four protein chains that come together with an iron element, and oxygen then can bind to that that iron and be transported in the blood. Because oxygen doesn't like to dissolve in water very much by itself. Unlike carbon dioxide will readily dissolve in water, but not oxygen. All right, so red blood cells don't live very long, and so a good question you should be able to answer for yourself is about how many red blood cells die in your body every second? How many red blood cells die every second? Maybe I have it on here. All it says, first line, right, between 2 and 3 million red blood cells every second, right, die. And in order to prevent you from becoming anemic, what has to happen? What maintains homeostasis? You have to build 2 to 3 million red blood cells every second in that hematopoietic tissue, namely red bone marrow. Okay. All right, so these are the organs that get rid of damage and old red blood cells, liver, spleen, and bone marrow. And they like to recycle this iron because your body can't make iron. That's an essential nutrient. And it's recycled to produce some more hemoglobin. All right, but I do want to put something on the board for you. When that red blood cell is broken down, all right, we get a compound called hemoglobin. Right, and hemoglobin then is broken down into, okay, it's broken down into proteins, and which is the globin part, right? Probably I should have put the proteins over here, and then the heme, right, comes out over here. Then we have heme. All right. So what can you do with a protein if you want to recycle a protein? You can break it down into amino acids, right? And then your body can make any kind of protein from those building blocks once again, right? So we just don't want to throw hemoglobin away. Heme, on the other hand, right, will break down into two products. One will be iron. Fe stands for iron, right? Remember that. Okay. And another product called there's a intermediate step, but I'm going to skip the intermediate step and just say bilirubin. Bilirubin. Okay. And bilirubin is pretty toxic, especially to developing nervous systems in a pre-adolescent individual. And we excrete bilirubin. All right, that's a big organic compound, but we can recycle iron. Our liver can store iron for us as well. And it's more important for a liver to store iron, or maybe you should tell me, is it more important for the liver to store oxygen if you're a male at 20 years old or a female at 20 years old? I think I heard the right answer. It's female, right? Because they lose so much iron every month, right? So it's a good idea to store iron. So females, at least during reproductive years, are not very sensitive to iron overload because they normally lose so much every month. But men, okay, have a much lower level of toxicity for iron because it can build up very rapidly in their body because they just don't lose very much. All right, so make sure you kind of know what the breakdown products of hemoglobin are. Okay, here is a nice feedback mechanism for maintaining red blood cells at the right hematocrit. So blood is flowing through the liver and kidneys, and when the liver and kidneys notice a reduced oxygen concentration, they will release erythropoietin, especially the kidneys, and that's a hormone, right? So that gets picked up by the blood, delivered everywhere, in particular to red bone marrow, stimulating red bone marrow to make red blood cells. And as we make more competent red blood cells, what happens to oxygen concentration? It increases, and that feeds back and subtracts from the initial stimulus, so that's a nice negative feedback mechanism. Okay, so that's erythropoiesis, the formation of new red blood cells. Okay, well, think of a cell membrane once again. Cell membrane, how could you describe a typical cell membrane? Just a basic concept of a cell membrane. What's the basic building block? Basic building block is, I'm going to leave that there, is a phospholipid. Yeah, a phospholipid. And a cell membrane has not just one layer, it has two layers, right? So think of the phospholipid bilayer. But that's not a really adequate description because within that phospholipid bilayer, things are added, like proteins, and maybe sugar-modified proteins. We call those glycoproteins. And some other kinds of proteins that act as identifiers. All the cells in your body have a particular identification on the cell surface, which is different from anybody else in the room, even different from your brothers and sisters. And it's a protein, and it has a different shape, right? So the shape of that compound on a cell membrane will then designate that it belongs to your body or it comes from outside your body, and that will trigger immune response. And those things are what we call antigens. So red blood cells do have antigens on the cell membrane, and they're in the extracellular side of the membrane. They don't point inside the cell, they're on the outside of the cell. And It was learned that when somebody was low on blood, we could get blood from a person and transfuse it into a second person, but it didn't always work right. Sometimes that caused a big problem where blood started to clump in the recipient. And then they realized that there are antigens that can react with antibodies if we're not careful. All right, what does this look like right here? Nice red blood cell, right? And what did we say is on the plasma membrane? Antigens, right? And they have a particular shape. So here is a red blood cell, and it's got a shape like an A. Okay? It doesn't really have a shape like an A, but we're just going to say A, because it just has to be different than something else. All right, so here we have a red blood cell that has antigen A. Here we have another red blood cell, okay, but it's got an antigen B. Now, what can you tell me about this red blood cell? Does it come from the same individual as this one? It does not, right, because it has a different identifier on it. All right, so then people realize we have this kind of blood type. This is blood type A, the first one they discovered, right? So the blood type is defined by the kind of antigen that's on the cell membrane. And so you could tell me what blood type this comes from, or what is the blood type of this red blood cell? It's B, right? And another circumstance, right, a person could be A, could be a combination, A and B. So tell me the blood type of this person. Yeah, that's AB. And then, all right, we have a third kind of cell that reacts, and there are no antigens. There are no A and B antigens on this one. What are we going to call this one? We can call that A, we could call B, we could call it C, right? The third one they found. But they didn't like C. And they're thinking, well, how are we going to think about this? And somebody said, oh, I have an idea. We're just going to call it O for zero, no antigens on the cell surface. All right, so that is the fourth type. And there are many other kinds of antigens on the surface of red blood cells, but this is the most important one, and it's there from birth. It doesn't have to be sensitized. We all have these antigens. Unless we're blood type O, we don't have it. And we call this the ABO blood system, ABO blood type system. But there are other kinds of systems that you should be aware of, too. Maybe I'll talk about one more. All right, so not only do you produce antigens, but you produce antibodies as well to protect your blood. And we're just going to call, we could call it antibody A, antibody B, but we're just going to call it anti-A, anti-B. But it's an antibody. All right, so a person will produce these things right away, right? It doesn't develop as you're an adult. So what kind of antibody can a blood type A person produce? Could a blood type A person produce an anti-A? Okay, if they were, then that antibody would attack this red blood cell. All right, so it can't have an anti-A, it's got to have an anti-B. And similarly over here, this person with blood type B produces an antibody that is what? Anti-A. Well, now we got a little bit of a problem because here we have a red blood cell that has both A and B on it. What kind of antibodies are produced here? It can't have any, right? So here is none, no antibodies, right? And then this person, type O, actually produces both. Both anti-A and B. All right, so those are the four blood types. Now, where you find these antibodies is not on the cell surface, but these are in plasma. All right, so antigens is a part of formed elements because it's on the plasma membrane. And antibodies, oh, we looked at them already, are what? In plasma. Like those globulins. All right, so make sure you know where antigens are located and where antibodies are located. All right. So if we take blood type B and put it into a person with blood type A, what's going to happen? Well, you have anti-A, right? Those antibodies are going to attack the antigens here. Why is that? What does an antibody look like? Antibody kind of looks almost like a guy standing right here with his hands up, and his hands, okay, his hands have receptor sites for the shape of that particular antigen. All right, so we're going to call this, all right, tell me what kind of antibody this is. Oh, okay, almost drew it wrong. What kind of antibody is this going to be? And what kind of antibody, okay, is this going to be? Can anybody see the shapes right here? What can bind to this right here? Can a B bind to that? Wrong shape. But what about an A? Yeah, A will fit in there, so this would be antibody A. Can an A antigen fit in here? No. But a B antigen can. Right? Now, they don't look exactly like that, right? But they just have different shapes. So, when you get a transfusion reaction, if we put this anti-A into somebody that has A, this antibody will bind one red blood cell and the other arm will bind another red blood cell. And then another antibody will join those two to another two, and then you have four, and that keeps going and going and going, and then you have a big clump of red blood cells. They can't flow through the circulatory system, and in that process they also lyse. What does lyse mean? It causes the cells to break apart. Okay, so that's what we call a transfusion reaction or agglutination. All right, so here is a pretty good slide that shows just what I drew on the board almost as well. Okay, and so this process right here we call agglutination. So if you're going to just briefly describe what agglutination is, what kind of reaction is it? What kind of reaction is agglutination? Okay, so here you say, oh, well, it's a clumping of red blood cells. Yep, you're right. But why does that happen? I want you to be able to verbalize the underlying process or principle that's happening for agglutination. Because we're going to look at something similar, but it's going to be different, and we've got to come up with a different term. So, oh, and I probably should have drew it on the board, but it is an, what is this thing right here? Antigen. What is this thing right here? Antibody. Agglutination is an antigen-antibody reaction. Right? Agglutination is an antibody-antigen reaction. And it can form these clumping of cells. And this is different than agglutination, which is what we mentioned just coagulation. Agglutination is different than coagulation. Okay, blood type O is a universal donor. That blood can be given to anybody because it doesn't have any antibodies, right, to attack somebody that's A or B. The universal recipient, okay, is AB because it doesn't make anti-A or B, so when we transfuse those red blood cells into somebody, okay, they're not attacked by that person's antibodies that are already there. Right, so it won't agglutinate that blood. Another kind of antigen system is what we call Rh factor. It's a little bit simpler. Rh factor is something that looks like this. Only two possible solutions. Here we have two red blood cells like this. And if the antigen is on the cell surface, right, what kind of blood type is this one right here? Just in terms of the what we call Rh blood system. And then we got a second one here. Okay, here is a person with that Rh antigen on the cell membrane. So this is what we call Rh positive. And this is what we call Rh negative. And these systems work together, they overlap. And so there are people that have all, you know, these A and B antigens and the Rh. So let's do this. I'm going to modify this red blood cell. What's his blood type again? AB, because of those antigens. Now let's put this on here. Now, what type of blood is this?
AB positive. What kind of blood is this? B negative. There's no RH.
What about this one right here?
A positive. Right, so that's how you would recognize these things. Now, that RH factor is a little bit different because it's not automatically placed. Wait a second. One thing I missed over here is what? Anti? What should I put here in this person? Anti-RH, right? Okay. Well, we're not born producing anti-RH. And a person will only start to produce anti-RH if they are transfused somehow or blood mixes within them that has that antigen on the surface, right? And once they have these red blood cells, once this negative person have these positive red blood cells in their blood, then the person starts to produce anti-RN and now is going to be very sensitive to blood that has this RH factor. And that became important because when somebody has a baby, there could be a mismatch, and the mom might be zero. What does the mom make? Anti-RH, right? And if the mom married or had a baby with the father who is positive RH, the mom is negative, right? Then there's a 50-50 chance that the baby is going to be positive or negative. And if it is positive, then the mother's anti-RH can attack the fetal red blood cells and break it down. And so we call that erythroblastosis fetalis or hemolytic disease of the newborn because those antigens do what? They cause hemolysis of these red blood cells. It can be treated pretty easily with something Rogam, which defeats that that reaction. Okay, so that's important, but does not happen for the ABO system, but it does for the RH. Anybody see why that might happen? Did you think that was kind of strange that one agglutination process happens, but the other one doesn't? And that's because these anti-A and anti-Bs can't get across the placenta, but the anti-RHs can. Right, so the maternal antibody RH can go across the placenta into the fetus, but the anti-B, anti-A maternal antibodies can't if there is a mismatch in blood of the fetus. Okay, hemostasis. Now we get into a different process, but before we do, the question is, what kind of reaction is agglutination? What kind of reaction is agglutination? It's an antigen-antibody reaction. All right, so now we're going to go to another topic, and it has to do with blood loss. All right, so this thing is important for transfusion reactions, but there are other things that we have to look at that maintain proper blood volume, for instance, when a blood vessel is damaged. Well, there are two kinds of processes that promote hemostasis, and hemostasis just means maintaining blood levels the way that it should be. So the first one is what we call platelet plug formation. This is for small tears in a blood vessel, maybe almost microscopic tears, which happen all the time. And the second one is what we call fibrin formation. So both of these, okay, are forms of coagulation. Notice coagulation is different than agglutination. So fibrin formation is for large tears in a blood vessel. All right, so let's look at these two processes. Here we have a picture of a blood vessel, and the blood vessel has an inner lining. Does anybody remember what that inner lining is called of a blood vessel? It's just the endothelium, right? And that endothelium is just a simple squamous epithelium. I can see it right here, right? It's just a squamous cell, one cell layer thick from the basement membrane into this free space up over here. So here we have an endothelial cell, and this is a nice normal endothelial cell. I don't see any damage to it. And it's attached to the basement membrane. The basement membrane has collagen fibers. Remember, that's one of the strongest fibers. And it also has, in this connective tissue, it has something that we call von Willebrand's factor. All right, so it has these little blue molecules in there as well. And it secretes a couple of this normal endothelial cell will secrete nitric oxide and will secrete something called prostacyclin. We're just going to call this PGI2. Right, PGI2. And these two compounds keep clots from forming because there is no damage to a blood vessel. Right? So these compounds are normally produced by a normal, healthy epithelium. Now, if there is a lot of arteriosclerosis and the cell becomes damaged, guess what happens? It doesn't produce these compounds, right? And so the blood in that area of that damaged blood vessel is more prone to form a blood clot. Right? So that's what's important about keeping a nice, healthy endothelium in your body. Okay, and that is, how do you maintain things in your body? Two things. Diet and exercise. Diet and exercise, right? Helps maintain this endothelium. Okay, on the surface of these cells, there's also an enzyme that will convert ADP, which is a breakdown product of ATP, into AMP, right? So these cells have this enzyme CD39, which keep ADP at a very low concentration. Now, and so these kind of look like red blood cells, but I want you to think of these things as platelets instead, right? Thrombocytes. This is a normal condition. And the blood vessel diameter is large, so the resistance in this blood vessel is low, so we make this term and this equation low. What happens to blood flow? It stays high, okay? Because we're not causing any kind of vasoconstriction. All right, now here I see some damage to the endothelium, right? So this endothelial cell was damaged, it's gone, and that exposes the basement membrane. Basement membrane has collagen, also has these von Willebrand factors. Now the von Willebrand factors then can leak out into the blood, attach themselves to platelets, and that causes these platelets to stick together, right? And then as they're sticking together, these platelets release ADP, and that helps bring more platelets to this area, and it causes them to get sticky and glue to the platelets that are already there. And so then this is just a nice positive feedback mechanism that develops, right? There is another compound called thromboxane A2, we're just going to call this Taxa A2, that's released by a platelet, right, when it starts to stick together with other platelets. And so that's a prostaglandin that helps this formation of what we call a platelet plug. So this is platelet plug formation. These platelets also release a compound called serotonin. Serotonin causes vasoconstriction of this blood vessel. So if blood can't get into this area, then of course it can't leak out. That is one of the important things about release of this Taxa A2 and serotonin. It causes vasoconstriction, reduces blood loss. Well, what happens if there really isn't a break in the blood vessel, there's no blood loss, but there's damage to this endothelium, okay, and then there's a buildup of ADP and serotonin, and these cells then start to release Taxa A2, guess what's going to happen to this blood vessel? Even though it's not leaking, it's going to vasoconstrict. And it might vasoconstrict to such a degree, because even these platelets are forming, that it could block that blood vessel just because this endothelium is damaged. And, of course, if that is a coronary artery, that's not a good thing, because where do you have coronary arteries? Anybody remember? Yeah, they're in your heart, right? So now you've blocked a blood vessel to the heart, and that will produce a heart attack. So under normal circumstances, this is a very nice thing, but okay, under certain circumstances, if there's disease to the endothelium, then that's a very serious condition. So somebody can get a heart attack even without a clot forming or even with a breakage in a blood vessel, right? It could be due just to these activated platelets responding to a damaged endothelium. All right, so Taxa A2 is a prostaglandin. There is a very common pharmaceutical that blocks the production of prostaglandins. Any kind of prostaglandin all over the body has many different kinds of effects. And in this particular case, right, aspirin blocks the production of Taxa A2. Right? And so that
inhibits this platelet reaction, and that just keeps somebody's blood from clotting, right, and keeps the vessels from vasoconstricting. So some people actually take a little bit of aspirin to block those prostaglandins all the time, just to keep their blood more in a fluid state. Okay, but if somebody takes aspirin and reduces this clotting function, what are they susceptible to? They're susceptible to bleeding. Yeah, they're going to bleed for a longer period of time and more extensively. That's just a side effect of that medication. Or if you're taking aspirin because it's a pain reliever, then the side effect of that pain relief would be what? An increased risk of bleeding. Right? Even you won't bleed to death, but it certainly will take longer. Okay, you will lose more blood. All right, so then after the reaction, we have this group of platelets right here. We call that a platelet plug. And the blood vessel is vasoconstricted, and that prevents blood loss. On this figure there, I see something that I do not like. See these filaments right here? Okay, I do not like to see that. Maybe it's okay. Is this color the same thing as this color right here? Is that maybe the same? And is this color maybe the same as this one right here? This one here, this one right here? Okay, well, it might be that some of these collagen fibers in the basement membrane, okay, do interact up in this layer right here with the platelets, but actually when you look at a platelet plug, I don't want you to think that there are many protein fibers in it, right? So from your mind, erase these protein fibers and just put platelets in this diagram. Can't do it, but in your mind you can do that. All right, so that's the first mechanism for hemostasis. It's platelet plug formation when platelets become activated. There's the second one. What did we call the second one? I forget. Fibrin formation. All right, so what is the role of fibrin? Where does fibrin come from? We talked about that. It comes from fibrinogen, right? Fibrinogen. Well, fibrin is a protein. And it's there to prevent blood loss. So if you were to damage a blood vessel, lacerate a blood vessel, you're going to be bleeding. And if you had to undergo protein synthesis to build fibrin to cause that to heal over that wound, right, it would take a long time, right? Because first, the genes have to be transcribed, make messenger RNA, then the messenger RNA has to be translated into fibrin. And as all that's happening, what's happening to you? As protein synthesis is starting, what is happening to you? You're still bleeding, okay? And so it would take, I can't even guess how long it would take to make enough fibrin to stop bleeding, maybe days, right? And by that time, of course, you'd be dead. So what has evolved is a system where there's plenty of fibrin in your blood, but it's not in an active form. It's not causing coagulation. It's inactive. And if it's inactive, we call it fibrinogen, and we have loads of that in our body, and it can be converted into fibrin very rapidly, right? So it's a reservoir of fibrin. Fibrinogen is soluble in plasma, but fibrin precipitates out and forms these strings of proteins, and it can form a network. And as blood is flowing out of that damaged blood vessel, this network of fibrin then can trap platelets, start a platelet plug reaction, can trap red blood cells and white blood cells, and then that forms a nice clot in that area. Okay, so let's look at fibrin formation. All right, I'm going to talk about this word slide for a little bit while we look at this figure here. All right, so this is an exam figure. Maybe you've printed out your exam figures already. Hopefully you have for this chapter, right? And you have some question marks. So you don't have to memorize every little thing on this illustration, but of course the question marks you have to know something about. So I want to talk about this particular diagram, okay? And it has to do with forming clots over damaged blood vessels. And so this is what we call coagulation. Coagulation prevents blood loss. All right, so let's review. What is a transfusion reaction? What's that called? It's due to agglutination. And how would you describe agglutination to somebody? What kind of reaction is it? Antigen-antibody reaction, right? coagulation has nothing to do with antibodies and antigens, right? It has to do with something that we call fibrin formation. Right? So coagulation is fibrin formation, agglutination is antibody antigen reaction. Two different kinds of things. All right, so in somebody's blood, there's plenty of fibrinogen. All right, so we're not going to be concerned about that if it's a nice, healthy individual, but we want to look at this pathway. There are two pathways, right, extrinsic and intrinsic, and then some of these pathways join together to form a common pathway, and then finally this common pathway produces fibrin, and that stops blood loss, that maintains hemostasis. All right, so the extrinsic pathway is a shorter pathway compared to intrinsic, and let's go over that one first. When more than a blood vessel is damaged, if some tissue is damaged, so there's more than collagen being unveiled to the blood, but when tissue is damaged, it releases thromboplastin. Thromboplastin is an enzyme, right? So you got to have actually really damaged tissue there, and that activates, all right, that's an enzyme. It will activate this another factor. You don't have to memorize which one it is, but this is factor 7. All right, and then factor 7, when it becomes activated, and what does it have to have to become activated? What does 7 have to have to become active? It says right here. It has to have calcium. Ooh, that's not such a big shock, but that's okay. Hopefully calcium is maintained within proper levels. And phospholipids. So in order for this pathway to work, you have to have calcium and phospholipids. Well, we know calcium is maintained at proper levels in the blood, but what about phospholipids? Where the heck are you going to get phospholipids from? That's the cell membrane of all those cells that were damaged, right? So it has these factors right here, and they come then activated, 7 comes over here, and then it can activate factor 10. Factor 10 can then activate another protein, and this one here we call prothrombin. So we talked about a term, a suffix that's used sometimes to say that a compound is inactive but ready to go to work, and that is what? Ogen. Here is a prefix that we put on words, pro, right, and it means the same thing. So prothrombin is an inactive form of thrombin, but it's ready to be converted into the active form right away. It can be converted into thrombin. All right, so what converts prothrombin to thrombin? And it is prothrombin activator. So factor 10 right here is prothrombin activator, right? And that converts prothrombin into thrombin. And this step is dependent on vitamin K. Do you know where you get vitamin K from? Green leafy vegetables. What's your favorite green leafy vegetable? You don't have any. A lot of people don't have any. But broccoli, for instance, is really great. It has a lot of vitamin K, right? So vitamin K supports proper blood clotting function. And for instance, if somebody's on anticoagulation therapy, maybe they have a prosthetic heart valve or something, right? They can't just one day eat a lot of broccoli, okay, and then the next day not, right? Because that will then misadjust the dose of anticoagulant that they are taking, right? So their diet has to be pretty much constant. They can eat broccoli, but they just can't change. Another sort of interesting case is my wild little nephews when they were kids, when they were maybe about 3, 4 years old, they'd rough house around in the house, right, and wrestle and throw each other, and maybe even their uncle picked them up and threw them, right, and invariably they would hit their nose on the floor, TV set, couch, table corner, leg of a chair, something like that. And my nephews hated broccoli. They would rather die than eat broccoli. But since they never ate green leafy vegetables, what vitamin are they missing? Vitamin K, which means they had depressed clotting function. So whenever they would hit their nose, they would get a nosebleed, right? And it would take a really long time to stop. And so they were worried, bloody face, and they would come to me, and what would I show them? I wouldn't be very sympathetic because I would say, see, you're not eating your broccoli. And I would talk to them about this extrinsic pathway and the common pathway and intrinsic pathway, but they lived through that, all right? So it is interesting that my nephews at that age would rather bleed to death than eat broccoli. Hopefully nobody in here hates broccoli that much. Okay, so that's the importance of vitamin K. Okay, so this intrinsic pathway can happen even in a test tube or when the endothelium is damaged. But so what do we see right here? We have different activators that can activate other activators, right? And then finally prothrombin activator. Right here is activated factor 10 is prothrombin activator, and that produces thrombin. Well, these are all, some of these steps are enzymatically controlled steps. So what do we have when we have a series of enzymatically controlled steps? So if the conversion from an inactive form to an active form is produced by an enzyme, we call that what? Just one level of amplification. Because what happens to that enzyme after it causes that reaction to take place? What about an enzyme? Does it get used up in the reaction? It does not. All right, so here's one level of amplification. Here's another level of amplification. So when we have a series of enzymatically catalyzed reactions in a series like that, what do we call this? Or what do we call this over here? That is a cascade. Right, with different levels of amplification. That just means that a very small stimulus can produce a very large response in a rapid period of time because you have all the necessary chemicals that can be activated very quickly. All right, so that's the importance of seeing this clotting, of these different clotting mechanisms. All right, and then in the intrinsic pathway, we do need an electrolyte and we need some other compounds. And again, this pathway here requires calcium, requires phospholipids, right, for that to happen. Okay, so all of this will activate prothrombin activator over here. Have you ever heard of a condition called hemophilia? Hemophilia is a congenital abnormality, and unfortunately somebody is missing a gene, and they can't produce factor 8. Right, so they can't have this activated factor 9 come over to the common pathway, and so they have way reduced blood clotting function because they just don't produce this factor 8 right here. So even a small tear in a blood vessel, right, they can bleed to death because they can't form a blood clot. Okay, that's called hemophilia. And it used to be relatively common, not so common anymore, because one way to fight hemophilia, when somebody starts to bleed, what's one therapy we could do for them right away? Well, we could match their blood type and give them a transfusion, right? And then they would have platelets and clotting factors, and they would replace that blood they were lost. Okay, but a lot of these patients unfortunately died of AIDS because they were transfused from blood banks way before we even knew what AIDS was. Okay, and it pretty much has wiped out the population of people with hemophilia as a result of that. I don't even know if there are any alive today still because of that. But that's because we didn't know anything about AIDS at that time. So let's look at this pathway. So here we have the first step, prothrombin activator formation, either from the extrinsic or intrinsic pathway. And prothrombin activator, right, will activate prothrombin, convert it into thrombin. And thrombin is an enzyme as well. Thrombin, it acts on what we talked about, fibrinogen, and it then produces fibrin. And what can you tell me about fibrin? What happens to it when it goes from fibrinogen to fibrin? It precipitates right out of solution and forms these proteins, the network of proteins inside the cell. All right, so that's what we call coagulation. It is what? Fibrin formation, basically via these three steps right here. I think when you study these, you should just know these three steps, right, that fit into the common pathway. But in the intrinsic and extrinsic pathway, they both require phospholipids and calcium. If you're low on calcium, you have reduced blood clotting function. And then one last thing that's not in your book, right? And so make sure that you see this on your slides. I hope it's in your slides. You see this arrow right here, thrombin. Thrombin not only activates fibrinogen, but thrombin can activate factor 11. All right, so factor 11 does what? It produces thrombin. Thrombin produces more factor 11, which does what? Produces more thrombin.
Okay. And when more thrombin is produced, that produces more activated 11. What's happening here? What's happening here? When something causes something else to develop, which then feeds back and then exaggerates that stimulus, right? And that produces more stimulus. So the response does not subtract from the stimulus, they add together. What kind of feedback loop is that? That's a positive feedback loop. All right, so thrombin operates in this positive feedback loop, right, and that's important. Without this positive feedback loop, then somebody will have way reduced blood clotting function as well. So this is not in your book, but I think that's interesting in this class that you should know about that. Okay, and so that will produce, as thrombin increases, that produces more fibrin. All right, so that's the scheme for coagulation. You don't have to memorize these things, but here's something interesting. You need calcium, right? You need some things in the blood that are inactive, like fibrinogen, prothrombin. And some of these things are enzymes, and they work in series with each other. So all of these are steps in amplification. So coagulation can happen very quickly because of this cascade mechanism. And what other things? What's one other thing that can produce a blood clot very quickly? Not only because of a cascade, but because of that positive feedback mechanism right here. Right? So that produces a very fast response that reduces blood loss. All right, so here's a nice picture of coagulation. I see a bunch of red blood cells that are all clumped together. So you might be thinking of an antibody-antigen reaction because red blood cells were clumped together with antibodies. But what is this right here? What's this right here? It's not agglutination. It's not antibody-antigen reaction. It is all those fibrinogen molecules that have been converted into fibrin, precipitated out in solution, forming this network. Right, so fibrin formation is what we call coagulation. Right, coagulation. And this kind of process can repair large tears in blood vessels, right? Large-scale damage. What can repair small tears in a blood vessel? Almost microscopic. It is the platelet plug formation, right? So platelet plug is one way for coagulant to take place. Fibrin formation is another. Fibrin, of course, is important for... here's a sign-in sheet. Oh, well, too bad. Okay, well, so you see a positive feedback mechanism there and producing a blood clot, which means then blood turns into a solid from a liquid state, right? And then that clot can't flow around in your body. It's basically useless. So with that positive feedback mechanism, you might be concerned, well, how come when we have damage to a blood vessel, why doesn't all of our blood clot? Why doesn't all the blood in our body just form this big plug? And then, of course, what would happen? Well, you would die very quickly, right? Because blood, no oxygen is going to your brain. All right, but so there's something, there has to be an antagonism also built into that process, right? So there's something that should break down a blood clot. Okay, well, after the wound is, after the wound is damaged, the blood clot has to be dissolved. And there is a compound called kallikrein. Kallikrein will convert something called plasminogen, which is in your blood. What can you tell me about plasminogen? It's inactive, but you got plenty in your body, ready to go to work. Right? Kallikrein converts plasminogen to plasmin. Plasmin is an enzyme, and it breaks down fibrin. And when it breaks down fibrin, what does it do? It breaks down the clot. It dissolves the clot. All right, so this is antagonistic to clot formation. And so there's always a little bit of clot formation and clot dissolution happening in your body all the time because these things are in balance. Right? Every once in a while there is imbalance to where somebody can't produce plasminogen. So if somebody can't produce plasminogen, what are they susceptible to? Blood clots forming, right? Even spontaneously. And that can happen in people. And it's really unfortunate when that happens because it's really hard to treat, right? When somebody has disseminated coagulation in their blood vessels, okay, due to this problem right here. Okay, well, some people need anticoagulants. Maybe they have a heart valve, which likes to produce clots. There are a couple kinds of anticoagulants. Some we can give to people, some have to stay in a test tube. There is a compound called sodium citrate, another one called EDTA, and these are what we call chelators. When we put this in solution, these things then bind calcium. They take calcium out of solution. Right? And so if they take calcium out of solution and that solution happens to be a test tube with blood in it, can blood clot? It cannot. Right from the intrinsic and extrinsic pathway, blood cannot clot. So chelators can be used to keep blood in a fluid state. And that's used all the time. But we can't give EDTA to a person. Right? Do we want to give ETA to a person as an anticoagulant? No, because what do you need calcium for? Muscle contraction, nerve, right, transmission, synaptic transmission, all kinds of things. Right? So we can't chelate calcium in somebody. That would be fatal. But there are other compounds that can be used. For instance, heparin activates antithrombin 3 that blocks thrombin. And coumarin blocks clotting by inhibiting activation of vitamin K, right? So both heparin and coumarin are what we call anticoagulants, right? Because they interfere with this coagulation mechanism right here. All right, so when somebody's taking an anticoagulant, what do some people routinely call that? What do we call those? What do people routinely call anticoagulants when they... because we're messing with this coagulation scheme right here. What do they say? I'm on a blood thinner. Okay, well, does their blood get any thinner when they take a blood thinner? Their blood does not get any thinner. It just disrupts this mechanism right here, but I suppose you could describe this to somebody and say, well, you really shouldn't say blood thinner, it's an anticoagulant because you're messing with this mechanism. My nephews even know that by now, I'm sure. Okay. So blood thinner doesn't thin somebody's blood. Okay. This thing right here, plasmin, is interesting. This has become a developing therapy. What happens if somebody has a blood clot, maybe in their brain, maybe in their heart, right? And what could be one mechanism to get rid of that blood clot and spare somebody from having a stroke or a heart attack? What could we give somebody? We could give them plasmin. Right, and that would break the clot down before it caused problem. And there are activators of plasminogen besides kallikrein. There's tissue plasminogen activator, TPA. And if you're in a hospital that's really sophisticated, one comes to mind that's really close, like Long Beach Memorial Hospital. If somebody is experiencing disorientation, slurred speech, then we think that there's something wrong with their brain. Right, we would call that a stroke, but a stroke could have two reasons. Right? A stroke could be due to a blood clot that's in the brain, so part of the brain isn't getting blood, or it could be due to a breakage of a blood vessel, so somebody's actually having a bleed inside the brain. All right, so before you give plasmin, you got to come up with a diagnosis to make sure somebody's not bleeding, because what happens if you want to help somebody that's having a stroke because they have bleeding in the brain and give them plasmin, what happens? You're making the bleeding worse, right, instead of better. All right. But if somebody has a blood clot, and you can tell this with MRIs pretty easily, then that would be one reason why you might want to consider, right, plasmin therapy or TPA therapy for that. All right. But of course, that has to happen relatively quick. So I think the bottom line for that is that if you have any family members, right, that are experiencing that disorientation, slurred speech, losing motor activity in their body, get them to a hospital right away, right, where they can maybe diagnose it, maybe they can institute some kind of therapy to reverse that thing as it's happening. So what's one of the things that when somebody's experiencing a stroke, guess what they like to say? Oh, I'm okay. Don't worry about it. It's not really happening, right? It's sort of denial, but you just have to be really forceful with them, right, and get them to a hospital quickly. That's, I think, the important message here. All right, so between now and Thursday, review your anatomy of the circulatory systems, pulmonary versus systemic circulations. Know which one has oxygenated blood and arteries. Oh, know the definition of an artery and a vein. Ooh, who can tell me a definition of an artery? What's an artery? Yeah, it has to do not with what it's carrying, but what the direction of blood flow is. So an artery is taking blood away from the heart. All right, so here's an artery. What about this? So here's a red artery. Here is a blue vessel. Is this blue vessel an artery or a vein? Okay, it really looks obvious that it's a vein because it's blue, but look at the direction of that arrow. Is it toward the heart or away from the heart? It's away from the heart, so this is an artery, not a vein. So arteries could be high in oxygen or low in oxygen, right? It depends on what circulation it's in, whether it's systemic or the pulmonary circulation. So take a close look at this as a review. Make sure you know all your valves. Probably you should know something about these blood vessels as well. What makes an artery different than a vein? And the third kind of blood vessel is a capillary. What makes a capillary different than an artery and a vein as well? So we're going to talk about that stuff next time. Okay. Sign-in sheet. Yeah, I'm not passing the sign-in sheet around today because it was too late by the time I remembered that. All right, so we're going to move into cardiac cycle pretty rapidly next time.